It's a foggy night on old Cape Cod. A perfect night for a mystery. Tonight, Cape Cod Radio Mystery Theater presents an original suspense thriller entitled Five Fathom Rip. George's Bank, the famous fishing ground, is situated 80 miles due east of Cape Cod, out on the very edge of the continental shelf. Here, incoming waves from storms far out in the Atlantic sweep in, passing over depths as deep as 6,000 feet. Then, seemingly in the space of a single rise and fall of a single wave, will suddenly be passing over shoals as shallow as only a few fathoms. Many of these shoals have names, especially the larger ones. There's George's Shoal, Cultivator Shoal, North Shoal, and Hambone. Down in the southeast quadrant, in an area known as Little George's, is a rip which goes by the name of Five Fathom Rip. It's a rip, of course, because of the way the tide rips along it. It's a strange, almost optical illusion effect. So far out at sea, you don't expect to look down and see ripples appearing on the surface when there's no wind blowing. Those ripples may look harmless, but they belie a tremendous force of moving water. Only a suggestion of movement, but it's the same sort of look, the same sort of suggestion you see in the water at the very crest of Niagara Falls just before it plunges over. Many times, Five Fathom Rip has been a scene of high drama, mostly the kind you'd expect. Fishing boats capsizing in heavy seas, boats icing up in winter storms, becoming so top-heavy they flip upside down. But for Bobby Winslow, what happened to him was nothing like that. What happened to him was much more unexpected, much more unusual. And much worse. Much, much worse.
It was all Hibbert's fault. Without him, this whole mess never would have happened. Or at least it never would have happened to me. Strange, I suppose, to lay the blame on somebody who wasn't even there. But then it's just as strange to say that the hero of this story is a shark. But the fact is, both are true. It was Friday afternoon. I was down working on my boat at the Sandwich Boat Basin, which is a little puddle of a marina built off the side of the Cape Cod Canal, just below where it empties into Cape Cod Bay. I was in a skiff working my way alongside a 50-foot wooden trawler I was dumb enough to pay $30,000 for out of dry dock. I was flipped over on my back, leaning halfway out, using a boat scraper to scrape rotted caulk from a seam down near the waterline, when I heard the sound of a big boat pulling in and swiveled my head in time to get an upside-down view of the Christina pulling in and Hibbert at the controls. I sat up to roll the kinks out of my neck and wonder what in the world it was that brought him in here. Ordinarily, the Christina operates out of New Bedford, fishes deeper waters. A boat her size is a fairly uncommon sight in the little Sandwich Boat Basin. Not arriving at any satisfactory explanation, there was nothing to do but stamp the lid back on the putty can and row over to find out. As it turned out, that was the first thing I never should have done. Hibbert is curly-haired, burly, stocky, somewhere in his middle 40s, which puts him about a decade ahead of me. He and I share a camaraderie dating back to the days when I used to crew for him. Now that I had a boat of my own and he had moved into a larger-scale operation, our camaraderie had loosened a bit, now that the overlay of competition was laid upon us. Hibbert, in addition to being salty, sarcastic, and gruff, is also a masterful cusser. Anytime he wants to, he can open his mouth and spew out the most wondrous, spontaneous outpouring of slurs, epithets, curses, derogatory remarks, plus any stray words that might wander in, which on closer examination might prove to be nonsensical, but which sound bad and therefore are good to use. It was one thing I admired him for. I could never cuss decently. Always wanted to, never seemed to develop the knack for it. He didn't see me approaching from the waterside. When he did, his face passed through several quick stages. Surprise. Alarm. Then a furtive secretiveness, all of which disappeared in a few split seconds.
Bobby Winslow, you low-light son of a mother-eyed bastard! You worthless spit, you curse-bag of a thunder-headed cretin! How the hell are you, anyway?
Hebert, what the hell are you doing coming in here?
I was lonely, and I just couldn't stay away from you any longer. I forgot how ugly you are, and I had to remind myself. Now, I'm coming in to make love to your wife, you decide.
That was Hibbert. He invited me up and then took me down below to the engine room to view the disaster. It looked like somebody had sprayed vegetable oil all over the place.
Fool, slimy stuff.
Yeah? So are you, damn hydraulics. Just getting in the way when the hose busted. It sprayed 400 gallons of this stuff all over the engine. All over the walls, down the bilge. Then I come to find out that some sweetheart of a son of a bitch borrowed my hose repair kit without telling me. When I find out who it was, I'm going to make the little scum sucker make the place clean.
We were on our way back up when I stopped.
What's in the hole? I noticed you riding low in the water as you came in.
Yeah, just our ice. We took on a few extra tons so we could stay out longer.
No fish?
Some fish. Like I said, we were just getting started. We were running our first tow when the hose burst.
I knew he was lying.
Must have been a heavy load to create that much strain.
He knew I knew he was lying.
Could have been. Or maybe it was just ready to let go. It happens sometimes. Let's get out of here.
Now, why don't we just look in here first?
No point in repeating what he said, but I'll tell you. What I saw when I climbed down into the fish hold, nothing could have prepared me for.
Holy jeez.
It was the kind of sight that suddenly reorganizes a person's life. The kind of thing a fisherman's dreams are made of. The kind of thing that only another fisherman, someone who's been there, who's done it, who's seen the size of normal catches, can possibly appreciate.
Holy mackerel.
I saw fish. Tons of fish. A motherload of fish. Not just any fish, George's flounder. Lemon-sole George's flounder, the best, the largest, the most succulent and therefore the highest-priced fish selling at auction. George's flounder, some as big as dinner plates, some like doormats weighing 6 pounds, 8 pounds, 10 pounds each. I was looking at fish, but I was seeing money. Stacks and stacks of it. Bills of currency piled head high, packed in layers of shaved ice, every one of them staring back at me with that wide-eyed, blank-eyed, fish-eyed expression. Sort of like Andrew Jackson's face on a $20 bill.
We're out on Little George's, Bobby boy, just south and west of Five Fathom Rip. Suddenly we were into them. I swear I never saw so many. Every toe was as much as the gear could take. And Bobby, they're not moving. And not going anywhere. It's like somebody come along and sprinkled them all over the bottom. And they're just waiting for us to scoop them up. And that's why I came in here. That's why I'm going to get this damn hose repaired and this bilge pumped out. And tomorrow, as soon as that little dink of a fish market opens up, I'm going to take out what I got. I don't care what kind of a beating I take on the price. And then, as quiet can be, I'm going to tiptoe back out there, and I'm going to make me a haul that's going to set history. A haul so big I'll retire, and I'll move to Florida, and live me the life of a lottery winner. And you, Bobby boy, are going to have to sit this one out. The boat of yours is in no shape to venture outside. Besides, I heard about the little situation you got yourself into.
Yeah, about that little situation. Has to do with my boat. She's an old Western Rig stern trawler, built in 1933. Western Rig meaning the wheelhouse is up forward. The fishing is done off the stern by net put over off a big net drum. She's still seaworthy, although she hardly looks it. Some of the timbers down below look like they came out of the Mayflower. The iron fittings, winch handles, brakes, turnbuckles, that kind of thing, are all so pitted and eaten away by rust they've taken on a spindly look. The topside floor decking is rotted soft. A knife blade penetrates half an inch of soggy wood before striking solid. But basically, she is still sound, especially for inshore work. Offshore is another matter. Well, anyway, as I mentioned, she was built back in 1933, which was the year that Prohibition was coming to an end. It was a happy-go-lucky time on Cape Cod when just about everybody but the Coast Guard shared a wink and a nod about the rum-running that was going on. Of course, now with the government's war on drugs, the climate has changed. But back then, most likely as a lark, the original owner decided to call her Smuggler. Now, basically, I try not to tell other people how to live their lives, and generally I appreciate the same. Just because I call my boat Smuggler doesn't mean I am one. In fact, I think it should be fairly obvious I'm not, or else why call attention to it? The name on the bow when I bought her was the Betty B, but since I don't know any Betty B's worthy of naming a boat after, and since I believe a boat ought to keep her original name the whole way through, I decided to change it back. So I sent in my papers, and I waited. And the 2 weeks it was supposed to take turned into 10, and still they hadn't come back. Without them, I was dead in the water. Literally, I couldn't go out. Not legally. Not according to Coast Guard Code of Regulations, Code 33 CFR 173, which states, "No boat shall operate without proper documentation on board at all times." All right, so maybe this was a problem I brought down on myself. Maybe this was just my own jackass stubbornness. But hey, listen, if you haven't got that kind of stubbornness, you haven't got what it takes to make it as an independent fisherman. So now the whole thing had blown up into a test of wills. As I saw it, a case of independence versus authority, the little guy versus big government. A case of not letting some bonehead government official sitting at some stupid gray desk somewhere inland, whose greatest joy in life is reaching out and making other people's lives feel like desk jobs too, a case of not letting a person like that have even the slightest say in what I could or could not name my boat. That was it. That was all there was to it. Sometimes I was determined never to give in. Other times I figured, if they wouldn't let me have that name, I was going to call her Usik, which is Eskimo for big prick. When people asked me what Usik meant, I was going to tell them it meant good luck. But to make matters worse, the Sandwich Boat Basin doubles as the headquarters for the Cape Cod Canal Coast Guard Station. Effectively, I was under house arrest. The truth of the matter was, so far it hadn't mattered all that much, my not being able to go out. My boat still needed plenty of repairs and modifications. Damn it, now was different. Now they were forcing me to pass up the kind of opportunity every fisherman dreams about. Well, I have a wife, and I have two kids to support, so I had a damn good reason to go out there, papers or no papers. Nobody's going to tell me I don't have the right to go out and put food on my own family's table by the honest use of my own two hands. I decided there was only one honorable thing to do. I was going to sneak out. It was Friday. By 5 o'clock, most of the Coast Guard personnel would be heading home for the weekend, leaving behind a skeleton crew, and they weren't the ones to be particularly interested in noticing whether or not a certain boat was still at its slip. With enough time to get ready, I could leave here by 10:30, under cover of darkness, make Provincetown by midnight, add another 10 to 12 hours to get out there, start fishing by noon on Saturday, fish round the clock. That would give us a solid 29 hours on station. Start heading back early Sunday evening, run all night, get into Boston just as the 5 a.m. fish market is opening. Sell the fish, offload them, then hightail it back down to Sandwich to get here before 9. That's when the Coast Guard personnel would be just driving by on their way to work. Simple, really. Hell, if it worked, I could do the same thing the next weekend. The only thing was, I had to have a crew, and that was not so simple. Not on a Friday, just as the weekend is beginning. I knew Granger was home and would definitely say yes, so I called him first. Then I made a quick visit down to a local hangout, a place called the Lobster and the Lighthouse, where I recruited four hands out of a group of strangers loitering around the bar.
Sure, I got nothing better to do this weekend.
Me too. Cut me out.
Let's do it. I need to talk.
Okay, be down at the boat by 7:30. I'm in slip 14 on the far side. The boat's name is Smuggler. And look, keep this quiet. Recruiting deckhands out of a group of strangers is not the generally approved of method for putting together a crew. It shows how broke everybody is these days that as soon as I mention how much each stood to make for a weekend's worth of work, nobody refused, even after I explained the risks. None of them had any experience, but I figured with Granger and me giving orders, showing them the ropes, we could manage. I loaded on 3 55-gallon drums of diesel to supplement what was in the hold, stowed them up forward of the wheelhouse, and then I pulled around to the back side of the fish pier and had them pour in 9 tons of shaved ice. Finally, we were ready. Quietly, around 10:45, we made our departure.
Holloway, pick up those lines and stow them in the lazarette. Johansson, you and... I'm sorry, what's your name again?
Crawford.
Right, Crawford, sorry. You and Johansson get down the hold and spread around some of that ice. Make some beds.
Right. Okay.
Granger, get the coffee pot going. That's first thing.
It's already going, Skipper.
It's an indication of how much I felt like a schoolboy playing hooky that I waited until we were well out of earshot before switching on the VHF. It has a roving scanner feature that monitors all channels at once, as well as channel 16, the emergency channel. I heard snatches and bits of conversations, half expecting to hear some radio voice from the Coast Guard chime in asking me where in hell I thought I was going. We passed the flashing red beacon at the end of the jetty. The fog was incredibly thick, but posed no problem. A storm passing through 2 days before had dragged behind it a big cell of high pressure. There would be ocean swells out on the bank, but they ought to be subsiding. We passed the last of the buoys, and I opened her up in a direct line for Provincetown, heading across Cape Cod Bay.
Here's your coffee.
Thanks. Right about here is where I snagged that shark last spring.
I remember. You made the papers.
Damn thing weighed 6 tons, for crying out loud.
Too bad it wasn't a great white.
You wouldn't say that if you'd been there.
A 30-foot-long female basking shark had blundered into my net. Basking sharks are harmless but grow to enormous sizes, whale sizes. When I got the net to the surface and saw what I had, there was no way to get her out of the net without first hoisting it on board. It was almost more than the winch could handle. When I did get her up, she took up the entire after deck, with part of her sticking out the back chute. Another fishing boat snapped the picture that ended up in the papers with captions referring to Hemingway's Old Man and the Sea. I worked like a madman to get her back in the water in time. Her thrashing made it difficult and dangerous. I had to cut the net lengthwise and use it as a sling to hoist her back in. In the end, I was too late, and all I could do was watch while her carcass floated away, belly up. A fisherman pulls a lot of life out of the sea, and sometimes, when things don't go right, he adds his own back into it. But a wasted life, a wasted death, brings no joy to anyone, particularly in this case, with a creature so large and gentle. By midnight, we rounded the hook, and I let Granger snooze while I eased us out into the Atlantic, trying not to think about the fact we were a poorly equipped, illegal fishing vessel venturing out into waters normally fished by boats twice our size. For a time, alone with my thoughts, I had to wrestle with turning back. Every mile out, the feeling got worse. We moved far out into the night. After a while, the feeling began to slip away. We were now so far out, it felt like there was no turning back, no point in turning back, which amounts to the same thing. Old fishing boats are rarely retired. They get sold and passed down, owner to owner, each guy a little broker than the guy before, each one gambling he can squeeze just a few more years out. Sooner or later, they all sink. When you own an old boat like this one, you know you're somewhere down near the end of the line. You just hope you're lucky enough not to be the last one to own her before she goes down. And if you're not quite so lucky, you just hope you're lucky enough to get off in time before she takes you with her. We made it to the spot where Hibbert had had his good fortune. It was coming up on midday. I was the only one who hadn't slept. Too much coffee, too keyed up, too much riding on our finding the same fish Hibbert had happened on to. A fresh breeze was blowing out of a cloudless sky. The ocean swells only moderate. No other boats in sight. All night long I had been wrestling with the disturbing notion that Hibbert had deliberately led me astray, telling me this place instead of the true location. Granger was showing the others how to rig the doors while I checked the bottom sounder. Nothing showed up down there, but nothing didn't necessarily mean anything. George's flounder are bottom fish, indistinguishable from the muck and rocks until they get up to move. A funny-looking fish, built like a throw rug, both eyes on one side. Dark brown on top, albino white underbellies, they move ripple-like, hugging the bottom. Unless they all get up and stampede at once, the sonar won't pick them up. We were using a dragnet called an otter trawl, a long, conical-shaped net, something like a Christmas stocking. At the mouth of the net are 2 8-foot-long metal plates, called doors, which help steer the net underwater and corral fish into it. Past the mouth of the net is the section known as the wings, which gradually funnels down until it opens up again into what's called the belly. It's in the belly that most of the fish congregate. I gave the order to begin the first tow.
Ready.
Let her go. I watched the doors go over, belly flopping on the crest of our wake, and then immediately diving under. The net trailing behind us with its bright orange floats bobbing at the surface disappeared into the blue, sinking its way through 50 fathoms. There's nothing more to see now, except the 2 cable drag lines unwinding off their pulleys, angling behind us off either side of the boat. I set a course running west-southwest, keeping an eye on sonar, making sure we didn't cross over any snags, like sunken ships. There's hardly a trip yet when we haven't pulled up pieces or other of sunken wrecks. Not so pleasant reminders. I looked back at the crew gathered around Granger on the back deck where he was giving additional instruction. Among my fishermen cronies, I had acquired a somewhat dubious reputation for several reasons. One, I had actual books in my library instead of movies. 2, I tended to be a tad bit more ecological-minded than some. 3, I had once committed the unpardonable sin of hiring a woman to crew for me on a scallop drag. Move which raised the ire of some and the eyebrows of others. Plenty would say I was lunatic to attempt a trip so hazardous with so green a crew. By green, I don't just mean inexperienced. Holloway looked like he was doing his best to battle seasickness. Besides me and Granger, there was Crawford, tall, sort of string bean muscular, long, stringy hair, drooping style Fu Manchu mustache. There was Johansson, dressed like a lumberjack with suspenders, the chipperest of the bunch. Contrasted with him was Raymond, whose last name was unpronounceable. He wore black jeans, a black leather jacket, dirty white tennis shoes. He had a lot of nervous energy, plus a tendency to swagger a bit, which I took as an attempt to conceal his own nervousness over how far out we were. Last was Phil Holloway, the youngest, who was thinking about college but hadn't decided. I waited 35 minutes more, then gave the order to haul in.
Okay, haul in. Let's see what we got.
The moment of truth. The moment I had been both dreading and waiting for. Fishermen are known as farmers of the sea, but what we really are is prospectors. A fisherman is never sure what he's going to find until he finds it. Never sure what he's got till he brings it up. Every time you haul in, there's anticipation. But the first haul of the first day out is doubly so because so often it indicates how the whole trip will go. You stand there in the wheelhouse, looking back at the cables winding in, searching for telltale signs. But there aren't any. Not with a drag line. What may look like extra strain on the cables may only be current, or the angle of your toe, or the size of the ocean swells you're riding. So you wait. Nothing revealed until the net begins showing itself.
What do you see?
Nothing yet. Any minute. Wait. Here come the doors. Doors are up. Robert, you handle that one. Raymond, take the other. Watch yourselves. Here's the net now.
Everybody pitching in, sharing the camaraderie of success. Johansson instantly sprouted a nickname. We called him Sven. Holloway got over his seasickness, started talking about affording college after all. How impressed his girlfriend was going to be. If only it kept on. And it did keep on. Amazing toe after toe, coming up bursting at the seams, filling the hold down below with a growing mountain of flopping bodies. We worked without stopping all that day, all through the night. Around 3 a.m, a nasty, threatening wind came up that should have made us move off into deeper water. The bow and stern began playing an unnerving game of teeter-totter as big swells rolled under us. We should have moved off to ride it out, but we kept working anyway, ignoring the extra risk that if the net snagged on the hard bottom and we hung up, our chances of capsizing or at least tearing the net to shreds were greatly increased. After a few hours, the wind quit blowing, and the current running against the waves quickly knocked them down to size. That was the only bad weather we encountered, as if weather had anything to do with it. We were coming up on twilight of the second day. I gave the order this would be the final tow. As it turned out, I gave the order one toe too late. The golden sun was coming blinding out of the west. The ocean calm, no wind, no clouds, a clear night's forecast ahead. The dome of the heavens was so opened up, even with the sun still visible. On the other side, stars and planets were already poking through the indigo. We were all of us exhausted. It was all routine now. Hardly any talk. Exhaustion oversoftening our exuberance. I was up in the wheelhouse, dazed, staring down at Granger, who was aft watching the cables wind in. No running commentary this time. The others, wherever they were nowhere in sight. Suddenly, I saw him lean forward and stare down into the water, staring hard.
What is it?
Skipper! We got something here! In the wings! I can't tell what it is! It's... My God! Skipper! It's a body! A human body!
What?
He couldn't tell at first. He didn't even realize it until he saw the lumberjack clothing.
Skipper, my God, it's Sven. It's Johansson. He's drowned.
Come on, hurry up.
What is it?
Get him up. Get him
what
in.
What happened? What is it?
Chief, it's Johansson. He's in the net. Yeah.
Swing him in here, Vlad.
No chance.
Granger was right. There was no doubting he was dead. His face was ghastly white, frozen in a death grimace. His arms reaching around to his shoulder blades as though he were trying to scratch at something. It wasn't an itch. It was the metal buckle joining his suspenders which had caught on the nylon mesh as it was going overboard. In seconds, he was yanked over, pulled under before he could even cry out. It was horrible to think about it. The heavy weight of the net dragging him downward through darkness while he struggled, vainly, until his breath ran out. Nobody had seen him go over. Nobody even realized he was gone. Holloway had been in the forecastle sleeping. Crawford and Raymond in the hold. Granger, whose job it was, along with Johansson, to set the doors before the net went over, had set his side and retired to the galley. I was in the wheelhouse. Nobody saw it happen. Even had we, it's doubtful we could have gotten him up in time.
Get him in! Come on! Hurry it up! Holloway, get the Joseph line attached. Granger, take the winch.
Okay, I got it.
The Gilson line is a thick, braided rope with a strong hook spliced to one end. It's attached to the net before hoisting. From there, it runs up to what's called a hanging block, fastened to the boom overhead, then down to the deck to another block. From there, it's wrapped twice around the power head. When the winch is engaged, it provides 20,000 pounds of line pull, enough force to hoist a heavy load of fish 10 feet out of the water and deposit them on deck. It can be a dangerous moment because of a thing called a riding turn. What happens is the line wrapped around the winch drum accidentally crosses over itself. In seconds it binds up, but the winch keeps right on pulling. Very quickly, one of three things will happen. The line breaks loose from the net and the net falls back in the water. The hanging block snaps off and comes crashing down to take the place of where your head used to be. Or else the line snaps off at the drum. When it does, it's apt to go flying through the air in a lethal arc that can slice off a limb like a weed eater cuts grass. Exactly where it snaps makes a difference. If it snaps on top of the drum, it'll take off an arm. If it's below, it's usually a leg. In this case, it was on top. And it was Granger's right arm.
Granger, watch it! Watch it!
Look into the face of a man who has just had his arm severed at the shoulder, and you'll see a look you won't ever forget. We all just stood there, his blood gushing out, his arm lying on the deck twitching, his face passing rapidly from disbelief into deepening shock. He sat down, and I tried to help him. Then he seemed to want to lie over on his side, a rivulet of blood crossing the deck, running out the scuppers. Then, staring at the wood grain of the decking in front of his face, very quickly and quietly, he died. I should have notified the Coast Guard, but I didn't. I didn't want to take a chance on Granger's wife hearing the news from anybody but me. Ignoring one more regulation at this point wasn't going to make any difference, not to the trouble I was already in. Certainly not to the two bodies lying ice down in the hold. If only I had quit one drag sooner, none of this would have happened. I thought I was going to make a killing. Instead, I made two. One man drowned in the net, Another, a close friend, dead because he was so preoccupied with the first death he wasn't watching what he was doing, and so he became the second. I had to get some sleep. Nothing mattered anymore. I set a course for home. Raymond and Crawford seemed freshest, so I put them on the first watch. I sent Holloway down to sleep and left word to wake me in 4 hours. Nothing much they could run into out here, and I'd be up again well before we entered the shipping lanes. I went below and climbed into a bunk. I don't remember a thing past the second shoe hitting the floor. Nobody was at the wheel. Nobody in the wheelhouse. The wheel was hard over. I straightened this out, cut the engine. I switched on the outside lighting. A scene on deck leaping from blackness to fluorescent daylight. I could see fore to aft and all around us. They weren't there.
What happened? Do you see Crawford or Raymond?
I don't see them. Where are they?
I think they're off the boat.
Boat?
Get outside and listen. Listen for calling.
Okay.
Hear anything?
Nothing.
Try calling. I'll look around.
Raymond! Crawford! Raymond!
I circled the wheelhouse. I looked down the fish hole, checked the engine room, the galley, everywhere. How had they gotten off? The dory was still on top of the wheelhouse. Had they fallen over? Could they both have fallen over? Why was the wheel thrown hard over like that? I went back out on deck, my mind still groping for an explanation. One had fallen over, the other turning the wheel to circle back and rushed out to help and fallen over too? No, it didn't make sense. And yet, as I stood there puzzling, it was as if some inner workings of my subconscious had figured it out and was trying to get through to me. That's when I saw it. And those same inner workings knew instantly what I was looking at and was able to warn me not to go over and pick it up. Without overhead lights, I never would have seen it. The lighting made all objects on deck stand out in sharp relief. I was looking down at the snap section of the Gilson line. I could see the frayed end where the rope had separated. Then I noticed, a little bit behind that, a piece of bright metal like a nail sticking through the rope. Someone had taken a metal shiv and inserted it through the braids, leaving an inch sticking out either side. What would happen when that piece of metal reached the winch drum? As the rope wound tight, the metal point would pivot against the drum, causing the rope to pole vault over itself. The result? A riding turn, guaranteed. So it hadn't been an accident. If that wasn't, neither was the drowning. Neither were the disappearances. Which meant...
What should we do? Should we try going back?
Yeah, definitely. Tell you what, stay here. Keep listening. I'll be right back.
You think they fell over?
I don't know.
How long can they last in the water?
I ducked down the companionway steps to the forecastle. Close the door. I keep a pistol wrapped in a plastic bag stowed in a hidden compartment beneath my bunk. It was there. I checked the clip. It was gone.
Skipper! Skipper, you in there?
Yeah, I'm coming. Just a minute.
Skipper, I'm looking. Maybe we ought to call the Coast Guard. They can send a helicopter.
Holloway? Holloway! Get away from the door! Holloway! Holloway, the door opens out! Get away from it! Holloway! Holloway!
He was on the floor, legs outstretched, slumped over, a 9-inch-long fish pick shoved up under his ribs with only the handle still showing. I drew back in and closed the door. I had to think. It had to be Crawford or Raymond, one of the two. Whichever one it wasn't was probably dead along with the rest. It was Crawford, then. It had to be. He was the only one big enough and strong enough to know that he could overpower Holloway the way he did. Why was he doing this? To settle a grudge? To keep the profits for himself? No, it was crazy. Should I call out to him? Try to negotiate? Find out what it was? Somehow I knew talk was useless. His stealth, his cunning, made it obvious this was some sort of game of survival. I had to have a weapon. The gun. Worthless without bullets. Wait. The fish pick.
Where is it?
It was gone. Crawford had come back for it. Stupid. Dumb. Either I start thinking smarter or it was going to be all over real quick. Crazy or not, Crawford had shown amazing ability to anticipate everybody's moves, as well as improvise. I'd better start doing some improvising of my own. Two options. Rush him or stay put. Staying put was out of the question. Rushing him meant going up the companionway steps into the wheelhouse. The wheelhouse was definitely high ground here. The engine controls were there. The radio. The lifeboat on the roof. There was another way up. It meant going through the engine room into the fish hold and coming up through the hatch. But both ways could be easily watched by Crawford at the same time. Ultimately, rushing him seemed like a poor choice. The plan I finally decided on was neither rushing him nor staying put. It relied on the fact that there was actually a third way up, a way I didn't think Crawford would know about. I picked it also because it was probably the last thing anybody would ever think of doing when they're 80 miles out at sea. I was going to abandon ship. I removed my shoes. I opened the forward locker and took out a duffel bag which contained a survival suit. I took a deep breath and then opened the cabin door. Moving quickly, stepping over Holloway, I slipped down the short hallway, past the galley, and went there, into the engine room. Total darkness. The door to the fish hold was behind the engine. I groped my way around to it and carefully began working the dogging latches free. He shut down the engine. I could almost feel his suspicions rising. The thinnest amount of light filtered down through the hatch cover overhead. The air was chilled because of the ice. I could see my breath. I wanted to switch on a light, if only for a second. There was a mountain of fish down here, two dead bodies, also possibly a murderer. But I didn't dare risk it. The center aisle in a fish hold is called a slaughterhouse. It, as well as all of the side bins, were chocked full of fish. At first, climbing on hands and knees at the top of the pile, I had to flip over on my back and pull myself along using the underside of the timbers, dragging the duffel behind me. In the darkness and confined space, it was claustrophobic. My nerves so on edge, it wasn't helping that the dead fish were spasming when touched, a muscle reflex making them seem alive again. I was reaching with my right hand to grab another handhold when my hand closed around a tennis shoe with the foot still in it. Thank God he didn't jerk or move. It was Raymond, dead as a codfish. How he died, I couldn't tell. But that he was dead was a foregoner. The underside of his body, the part in contact with the ice, was already taking on the characteristics of frozen meat. I pulled him by the legs, slid his body past me to make room for myself. I shoveled fish out of the way until I was able to clear space around a little crawl-through door that led into the lazarette. I got it open and wiggled through. The lazarette is a small stoop-over storage area back by the stern. It houses the steering assembly, connecting the wheelhouse with the rudder, a contraption of pulleys and cables. Using a screwdriver, I took a few seconds to do some anti-repair work on the mechanism. If I did make it off, I didn't want him coming after me. Quietly, I lifted the manhole cover and put it aside. I poked my head up. The overhead lights were still on. The big net drum over my head was throwing a shadow over me. The chafing gear of the net hanging down provided an actual curtain I could come up behind. I couldn't see him. Hopefully, that meant he couldn't see me. Because of the bulkiness of the suit, I couldn't get into it until I was up on deck. If he saw me or heard me while I was getting into it, or while I was slipping over the transom, I'd be helpless to defend myself. Moving quickly, I was up on deck in seconds, slipping my legs into the rubber legs, my arms into the arms, the hood around my face. Now the only part of me exposed to the elements at all was a small circle around my face. I sat down clumsily, rolled onto my stomach. Holding onto a line, I lowered myself into the water. I pushed off, paddling backwards, anxious to make it beyond the circle of light into the surrounding dark. I maneuvered to keep the net drawn between me and the wheelhouse as much as possible, knowing if he looks back now, under these lights, I'll show up like a neon bobber on a fishing pole. Trying to move in this thing was like trying to swim wearing five overcoats. The thick, buoyant foam rubber kept me floating on my back, high up, in a sort of recline-a-lounger position. The little paddle stroke I was doing with my hands was the only way I could move at all. It was maddening. Here I was, racing for the dark, having to get there doing a ridiculous duck paddle. At last, I entered the darkness and disappeared. Now he couldn't see me. I kept moving, further off, looking back the whole time, looking for Crawford to appear. I could see all of Smuggler now, see how low in the water she was riding, her belly so full of fish. Moving away, I kept watching, the boat showing up now like a solitary car someone had abandoned under a street lamp. Still, no one visible on deck. Just then, movement. A blur running from the wheelhouse. A shadow diving down the steps. The next instant... things falling all around. Flaming timbers landing with a loud splash. A hiss and going out. Fish heads, pieces of fish falling. Shaved ice drifting down like snowflakes. The burning slick of diesel fuel illuminated in a firelight glow what was left of Smuggler, still afloat, her wheelhouse, most of her deck wiped away, gone, the rest on fire. The propane tank in the galley had gone first, setting off the acetylene for the welder's torch, then the diesel, including the extra drum stored in front of the wheelhouse. What had Crawford done? Was it accidental or intentional? Some sort of act of suicide designed to take me with him? A murderous scheme gone awry, catching him in his own devices. I'd never find out. Another sound came into my hearing. Behind. I swiveled myself around. It was Crawford coming at me.
Stay away from me, Crawford!
He had me by the foot. He was towing me towards the burning slick. He was hurt, badly hurt, losing blood, but it wasn't taking much strength to overpower me. I couldn't reach him. I couldn't sit up. Couldn't lower my legs. Couldn't kick hard enough to make him let go. Couldn't paddle hard enough to resist the irresistible force of him pulling me towards the burning. He was turning me, getting ready to float me into it. Next thing I knew, we were moving. Sideways. Not just me, both of us. Him towing me, something underneath the surface towing him. I saw him reach down to fend it off. The tail of a large fish swirled beside my head. His arm came up, shreds of flesh hanging down. He was trying to climb on, use me as a raft, get out of the water. But it was too late. The shark had already made its turn. The fire slowly burned itself out. More sharks came. 30,000 pounds of exploded fish was enough to call them in from a long way off. But the ones that came fed quietly. No frenzy. Just fish going about their supper. For hours I rode the up and down seesaw of ocean swells and looked up at stars so brilliant it's like I had never seen them before. Except for a faint purplish light on the rim of the horizon, the sky above and the water beneath were exactly the same. Except in one case, the myriad stars were fixed in the heavens. In the other, they swam around whenever I made a swirl in the water. Another kind of stars appeared when I dug deeper and stirred up the phosphorescence. I don't know why I wasn't worried. Not about sharks, not about where I was, all alone. I felt completely safe. Stirring up the phosphorescence was like stirring my arm in champagne, so wonderful did it feel to be alive. I raised a silent toast to Granger and the others who died. My boat, now sunk. All fishermen, fishermen's wives, to the stars and sharks. Yes, even to the Coast Guard, without whose meddling I never would have bothered with survival suits. In the morning, when I saw a boat approaching, I thought it might be the Coast Guard. But it turned out to be the Christina, with Hibbert poking his head out the wheelhouse.
Hibbert, you fish for brains! Sawed off liver of a goosefish moron!
Goodness gracious, did that come out of me?
It's your fault I got into this!
My fault! My fault, is it? I gotta let you swim back, you pirate!
Maggot!
Thief!
Maggot!
Pirate thief! The Lord of the Isles, my sweetheart! Hear me! The Lord of the Isles!
You have been listening to Cape Cod Radio Mystery Theater's presentation of Five Fathom Rip. The actors in tonight's play. Bobby Winslow was played by Stephen Russell. Bob Gianferanti was Hibbert. Bill Dame was Granger. Art Devine played the part of Holloway. Tonight's program was produced, written, and directed by Stephen Thomas Oney. Engineering by John Todd. Original music by Mark Birmingham. Special thanks to Skipper Bobby Cole for allowing us to borrow freely from his life, and to the rest of the crew of the Rams, Pete, Jeff, Rich, and Phil, for providing a little more realism than necessary on that particular Halloween night at sea. This program is copyrighted by Stephen Thomas Oney for Cape Cod Radio Mystery Theater. This is George McComble, wishing you a pleasant evening and inviting you to tune in again when the fog rolls in on another chapter of Cape Cod Radio Mystery Theater.